no one's right until we can actually do it. I think that that's the key. But just like we didn't know if we would be right or about driverless cars 15 years ago.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a group of the smartest minds and clearest thinkers working at the frontiers of artificial intelligence to banter, debate, and navigate their way through the week's news. On this week's episode, we've got Sandy Besson, AI engineer, Mihai Crivetti, chief architect, Watson X Orchestrate, and distinguished engineer, Gabe Goodhart, chief architect, AI Open Innovation, and welcome to you three, and welcome back to the show. We've got a packed episode today, as always. We're going to talk a little bit about trouble at Blue Sky. We'll talk about cognitive surrender in San Francisco. But I actually want to start today by talking about data centers in space. So this is a topic that we've touched on a couple times before at MOE, but is kind of newly relevant. I've been thinking about space. Hopefully, if you're a listener, you saw the Artemis II launch, which was incredible. But more generally, under the surface, there is a lot going on more close to home in the realm of data centers in space. So there's news this week that SpaceX has confidentially will be filing for IPO and is going to seek a valuation, a combined entity of SpaceX, XAI, kind of the whole Elon Musk empire, of over $1.75 trillion. It's a big, big number. Similarly, there's a company called StarCloud, a Y Combinator startup that's one of the fastest unicorns ever to come out of the program, which just raised a Series A of about $170 million to do data centers in space. And I want to talk a little bit about this because obviously we have this very kind of frothy activity happening in the markets. And Elon, of course, has been on social media talking about data centers in space. At the same time, we've got this great article from Antonia Davison at IBM on the Think blog, talking about kind of the science and engineering behind data centers in space. And she's got this incredible quote where she just kind of goes through and says, OpenAI's Sam Altman has called the idea, quote, ridiculous. A Gartner report basically talks about the excitement as, quote, peak insanity and a bubble. And there's even a popular science YouTuber, Kyle Hill, who called orbital data centers, quote, a stupid idea for almost every reason. And so maybe, Sandy, I'll start with you. What's going on here? How do we square the clear excitement around orbital data centers with, I think, a lot of skepticism, I think, from commentators, market analysts, and otherwise? Who's right? Are both of them right? How should we think about this?
No one's right until we can actually do it. I think that that's the key. But just like we didn't know if we would be right or about driverless cars 15 years ago, unless someone has a vision to do it and sets out on that vision to try to make it happen. And yes, the first ones might be prohibitively expensive. I think the article mentions that it would cost something like four times almost the amount to run a data center in space as it would potentially here on Earth. And a lot of that technology doesn't exist yet. But it's not even just about the end goal of the data center, which maybe it is for some, but for a lot of us here on Earth, it's also about the progress technologically that we can make in the discoveries for how to operate equipment in space. It's not just going to help us for data centers, but it's going to help us for whatever future space activity we have, or even discoveries on how to run technology in different environments that we're not used to.
That's good to know. Gabe, I see you nodding aggressively. I guess you're saying nay to the naysayers, I guess, implicitly, but curious about how you think through this.
Well, no, I just love the way you phrase it, Sandy, that we just don't know until somebody does it. Like, and I think when this article came across as a topic for this week, it reminded me of a previous segment I was on where we talked about this. And I naively said, oh, it's space, infinite cooling, what's not to like? And then I think someone in the comments called out like, no, that guy's totally wrong. He has no idea what he's talking about. And it's true. I don't. I am not a physicist. I actually know nothing about the physics of space. And I thought one of the things that was really compelling about this IBM Think article was that it actually broke down a lot of the deeply technical problems that would need to be solved for this to become feasible. And I think, you know, this really is in the domain of science. There's a whole lot of hype around it, but the science is maybe possible. So I think my read of the hype is that there's just huge error bars on this. And I think your point is also really well taken, Sandy, that like there are so many big challenging problems here that we could end up with a really amazing invention for running data centers underwater or, you know, in who knows where that actually ends up being the real value of these scientific explorations, because that's the nature of science. So I think maybe. And if it works, it's great. I mean, the one big challenge that I didn't see discussed in the article that I think will have to be solved at some point is maintainability. I think I mentioned this the last time we talked about this, but you obviously can't just walk over to a rack when it's orbiting the planet and yank out a bad H200 and stick in, you know, whatever the latest gen GPU is. That
well,
just doesn't
it's
work.
Just really expensive and complicated.
Really? Well, how are you going to catch it? You got to have orbital trajectories to literally catch the darn thing.
True. Yeah,
so,
that's a good point.
And I, you know, in a previous life, I was working in defense, and one of the adjacent projects was around orbital tracking and debris. And that's a real problem. It turns out to be very, very difficult just to get the basic math of watching all the things that are circling around the planet. And I think it was mentioned in the article as well, but when things crash into each other in space, that makes even more chaos. And the number of dead satellites and just space junk that's floating around our planet has reached a mathematically very challenging space. And if that explodes exponentially, then we hit, you know, serious, serious problems in terms of risk mitigation. And so if the, you know, I think there's a quote in there that says, you know, space is called space for a reason, which is true. But when you start thinking about the physics of that space being limited to what can reasonably orbit our planet, that gets much smaller and much more crowded much more quickly. And the maintainability of that literal space gets really difficult. So that's the part that I think, even if we get all the challenges of making it happen, it's kind of the software product that has no versioning strategy, right? Like, what do you do when you need to change something? I don't know. It's just scrap it and start over again. Who knows? So that's my biggest concern with this, other than obviously all the really, really difficult scientific challenges.
Oh, sure. I think in true engineering fashion, if you ask how instead of why, you're going to find some interesting problems to solve. Obviously, the first one is going to be heat dissipation without air. And I can see some interesting applications of this in traditional data centers as well, where the power density is getting quite high, thanks to GPUs and racks that now consume, you know, 10 times more power than your traditional rack of previous generations. You're going to see, for example, potential for radiation damage. So if you know, for example, IBM has produced a number of power-based chips for use in outer space that were isolated and shielded and very reliable when it came to using space or having chips that are redundant. So I think we can see more redundant hardware potentially come out of this exercise. Then there's the power generation and storage. So if you think about it, where do you store the power, right? Because you might need to have batteries in space, or you might need to have solar panels which store that energy for peaks and all those other kind of activities. So you might see better batteries, or you might see better power generation or better scheduling algorithms to use them when power is more readily available. Then you have the launch constraints, right? That thing is big. Like, you know, GPUs are big, they're heavy. If you've ever made a mistake, as I did, of buying a data center, I've done that. I actually bought a data center on eBay, and a number of trucks showed up, and they started to unload racks after racks after racks, and I had about 3 racks, one in every room of the house. They're big and they're heavy, and they take up a lot of space and power. And servicing them is insane. You know, so you need 2 people to lift it. That thing is 50 kilos, right? I think maybe smaller, lighter, more modular, more serviceable hardware could come out of this experience. Yes, it's very hard to service something in space, but maybe the hardware designs we have today are not necessarily the most efficient. They're not necessarily the lightest. They don't use the materials which are probably optimal for use in space. So while I do see this as still within the realm of science, it is far-fetched that we're going to have something in the next 5 years at the scale of what we have on Earth. But there are some secondary research topics which could come out of this exercise, where you're going to get smaller, cheaper, more serviceable, more resilient hardware that could be easily maintained in conditions where you don't have humans to attend to it. So, you know, lights out data centers or data centers, as Gabe put it, at the bottom of the ocean, as Microsoft, I think, has tried for a number of years, or even, you know, container data centers, as I think some Microsoft systems tried about 15 years ago, where you can ship a container, install some kind of cooling on it, and then you're good to go. So I do see it as an interesting area of research, not something that's going to be realistically powering the data center of the future for AI research in the next 5 years. But it has the potential to generate some interesting innovation out of it. And I think SpaceX is well positioned in this space. They have batteries, they have solar, they have, you know, satellites and internet providers. So they're in the space to do this research and potentially come out with something interesting.
Yeah, I think that's the argument in favor, right? Is like, if anyone's going to do it, probably will be them. But sort of big if true, ultimately.
Don't expect we're going to train massive large language models in space in the next 5 years.
Yeah, yeah.
But we can see some interesting innovation.
Well, and I think that's actually, if we have a final few minutes on this before we move to the next segment, is like to just do the sci-fi thought experiment, which is, say we solve all these problems. What are the workloads that you do in data centers in space exactly? Training, maybe, I guess? Or are you running agents off of these centers? Or is it mostly inference? Is it mostly providing intelligence to other assets in the sky? Kind of curious if anyone wants to venture like a more futuristic guess of like, if you solved it, what would it be cool to use this for?
I'll take a shot at that, which is, what's really the advantage of having that thing in space versus on Earth? I think it's proximity to the satellites. So it's workloads that depend on real-time access to data. So maybe you're going to do, you know, image recognition of satellite data in real time. I don't know.
If we think about Starlink, it kind of has the same purpose, right? Starlink provides internet access to places where otherwise it's inaccessible. And so similarly, unless you're running something locally on a device or somewhere, it could provide that same type of access to real-time AI inference in places where it's inaccessible. And then also, like, piggybacking off of what Mihai and Gabe said earlier, what a fantastic opportunity for different disciplines to come together, right? We have the maintenance aspect. Maybe we have a lot of robotics that needs to be involved because of the maintaining the stuff in space. We can't get to it, so maybe something else gets to it. Things like that. We have about... I went deep into this. This is one of the topic areas where, you know, you send something and I'm like, this is cool. And I go deep. And I learned we have about 11,000 satellites in space right now. Most of them come from SpaceX. In the 2030s, it's projected to have about 500,000 satellites in space right now, in space, right? So we already have a massive projected increase in the amount of stuff in space. I anticipate that this will probably account for some of that rather than potentially adding to it, I hope. That comes with all sorts of other things we need to think about: maintenance, space junk, things flying into each other and wreaking havoc down here on Earth and in other parts of the ecosystem. So I think it's just a general, almost like space, an infinite topic where there's just so many variables you can think about.
Great. Well, we'll keep an eye on it. I'm sure this is not going to be out of the news anytime soon. A lot more to come on orbital data centers and their practicality or non-practicality. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Kind of an interesting story. I have not been on Blue Sky, which for our listeners, they may know, is sort of launched as kind of a decentralized web competitor to a social media platform like Twitter, for instance. And it has gotten a lot of attention. But this week, there was a really interesting story. Blue Sky, the company, sponsored a conference called Atmosphere. And they announced at the conference that they were going to be launching a new AI assistant account on Blue Sky called Addy. And the response has been, unfortunately, kind of negative. Blue Sky users have banned Addy at an incredible rate. I think it's the second most, I believe, most banned account on the platform. And in general, there's been a big revolt over the kind of implementation, the integration of AI into Blue Sky as a platform. And I think I wanted to raise it just because I think like one of the most interesting questions in AI, for me at least, is where are we okay with AI kind of like butting, you know, sticking its head in? And where are we comfortable with that? And this clearly seems to be a case where, you know, I think like the sort of users of this platform have said, we actually don't want AI kind of floating around on our social media engaging with us. And so I guess, Gabe, a question I had for you was basically like, do you think this kind of like, you know, should give us some skepticism that like the future will be one where, you know, humans and AIs are kind of just talking very seamlessly in, you know, many of the social spaces that like we interact with online?
I think it wouldn't make me skeptical of that as the future. But what it would, what it indicates to me is that there's a segment of the population that is starting to be intentional or care intentionally about where AI is acceptable and where it's not. And I think, you know, the interesting thing about this one is that the authors of Addy, the Blue Sky team that launched Addy, were very intentional about trying to make Addy the not bad AI, right? The only point of Addy was to help you get a job done. And I think the fact that even that attempt to be the most acceptable AI there is has such massive backlash points to the fact that it has actually nothing to do with the content of the AI in this case. It has everything to do with the presence of the AI. And I think the thing that resonated with me about this is something I've been thinking a lot about, which is even if you take away a lot of the doomsday scenarios of AI, there's a very subtle element to all of the efficiency gains that we are attempting to eke out of this AI ecosystem, which is the loss of human-to-human connection. And essentially, even if AI is only acting as an intermediary between humans, right? A human creates some content and AI acts as the access point to that content, and another human uses that AI to access the content. You're taking away the direct human-to-human connection. And I think in this case, you know, Blue Sky is a platform that was deliberately launched as an alternative to an ecosystem that was very clearly trying to push hard on the envelope of let's lean into everything without any guardrails. And the I think clearly the desire to maintain that human-to-human element, even if fundamentally it is harder, less efficient, I think that's part of the raison d'etre for a platform like this. So I think what we're going to see here is that there are going to be communities like Blue Sky where it's intentionally not optimized because is designed to maintain the human-to-human element. And that's, I think, that's the lesson I'm going to take away from this one, is that there are spaces where we shouldn't AI, even if AI could actually make our lives easier in those spaces.
Yeah. Mia, are you sympathetic to that? I mean, I think this is kind of like the interesting thing. Like, Gabe, I think that's exactly right. Is like, I think what's so maybe poignant about this story is that you had a team that was trying really hard and like pretty sensitive to what the community wanted, but still no, right? And, you know, I guess the kind of interesting question here is like whether or not there will be spaces that just kind of remain kind of permanently un-AI by design, and that communities will be able to actually kind of enforce that in a certain sense. I guess, yeah, curious if you're like, you buy that, or if it really will become like almost like a very eccentric thing in the future, like, oh, your community doesn't have any AI? Like, what's wrong with you, you know? Or like, oh, that's really strange.
I think we've reached AI fatigue, where every single industry and every single platform is now crawling with AI agents and assistants and bots and fake inauthentic accounts. And I got it to a point where, for example, when I'm browsing social media, I assume that at least half of the accounts or channels or ads that I see are AI generated with the goal of tricking me into giving them money. That's my personal assessment of how I feel. And the ads I'm seeing on many of these social media platforms are not helping, because a lot of them are, you know, for example, you've got a guy that's either 40, 50, 60, they're starting to work out, they're exercising, and it's all clearly AI generated. to get something out of me. So even when an AI agent is coming out of Blue Sky, my immediate thought is, what's the ultimate goal? What are they trying to do? Are they trying to get money out of me? Are they trying to scam me? How can I tell this is one of the good AIs from what is 99% of my experience?
Which is bad.
Every single AI is trying to get money out of me in some way, shape, or form.
Sure.
So I think we've reached that AI fatigue. And I think it's also the question of authenticity, right? So if you're a photographer, for example, you hate AI. You hate AI-generated images. They seem fake. So I think we have reached a point where even well-intentioned AI agents on platforms such as this are going to be seen with tremendous skepticism by the general public.
Yeah. And so I guess in some ways, I don't know, Mihai, if I hear you right, you're almost saying like it's justified. Like actually, you know, this is actually a pretty rational response to what's going on.
It's not an agent that's helping you in your day job and you have, you know, reasons to use it. It's on a social media platform. So immediately you think, okay, what are they trying to sell me?
Sandy, thoughts on all this? I don't know. That's put me in a very paranoid state of mind. But.
Well, to what Gabe was saying, I was driving last night, like past Palo Alto, and there's literally billboards that say, curated by humans, by a human chef, not ChatGPT or not AI generated, you know, nutrition by humans. We're seeing an evolution in the way marketing and advertising is done. Now, whether or not that human used some AI, who knows, right? We're also getting to the point where it's becoming so embedded in our work, in the expectation of our work, and the productivity in our work, where there is frankly almost nothing that I do now that doesn't touch some element of AI, even if it's mostly me generated. But I think the perception of being human-driven versus AI-driven is really important. And I mean, I'm being a little facetious here, but I'm sure that every single large company, or even not large company, has a board member that is going, how are you using AI?
Uh-huh. Sure.
Right? And so it's a natural response to figure out the best way to use AI in your company, because that is what everyone is doing and no one wants to be left behind. Now, for a specific user base like Blue Sky, maybe that wasn't the right, you know your customer use case. But at the same time, I wonder what the reaction would have been if it was not presented like a, here's AI, happy, like ready to help you. And instead, here's some AI behind the scenes that's doing fact checking and deep fake alert and content filtering and all these other things that humans don't do as well, that AI can truly be beneficial for humans. And I think that's what they were trying to do, but clearly they just missed the mark with their audience.
Gabe, maybe a final thought on this is, where do you think this backlash goes? You know, like I could imagine one world where it's almost like, get the AI out. And then I think the other paradigm is almost what Sandy's saying is like, just don't make me think about it being AI, you know? And like overall, these systems kind of fade more into the background and like, maybe we don't even chat with them anymore, right? They're just like, because we don't really want to deal with that all the time because they're always trying to take my money.
Yeah, I think the answer is both and neither, which is a useless answer, of course. But Sandy, I loved your anecdote of seeing the made by humans or genuine human on the billboards outside Palo Alto. And I think that's really kind of a signal that the rest of us are kind of reaching that tipping point of saying, and to your point, Mihai, it's like, I'm starting to just assume AI is ubiquitous. And now I'm looking for the signal where AI is not present to be part of my heuristic for authenticity and trust, right? And the analogy to take it to a different domain that I've talked with folks about in the coding domain, right? It's starting to reach that point where if you're not using a coding assistant, like, what are you doing? But at the same time, I love writing code. Like, there's just a Zen mode that I get into where I just get it. Like, I frame it out beautifully. Like, I get my comments in the right places. Like, it looks beautiful. I make sure I actually chop my lines at 80 characters. Like, it's my beautiful code, and I love it. And the analogy that I've been using in my head is sort of the craft of coding and sort of the joy of maybe artisanal coding, we'll call it one day. It's pretty akin to that backyard garden I have, right? Like, I'm not actually gardening to produce the food for my family, right? That would be wildly inefficient. But I actually love the experience of, you know, in the springtime, getting the plants, getting them in the ground, making sure they're growing, watching little fruits start to bud on the various whatever. Like, it's really enjoyable to me. It brings, and it keeps me connected to the idea of sort of the authenticity of the food, even if that's not actually providing the sustenance for my family. And I think in many spaces, to your point, Sandy, we're going to have AI starting to do the heavy lifting, much like industrial farming is, right? Like, we're going to have these places where we're not thinking about the fact that it's AI, it's just the thing powering the efficiency engine. And yet, we're also going to have spaces where we very intentionally want to connect to the craft of whatever that domain is, whether it's coding, whether it's writing, photography, any sort of artistic pursuit, or even just like the sort of type two fun of having to walk your way through some documentation to figure out how to set up your own social media channel on Blue Sky, right? Like, that is fundamentally the point that they tried to make for Addy. It's how do you set up your own custom channel so you're not getting bombarded with ads, which is the irony of this story, which is like the whole point of it was to get you out of that malaise. And yet, the fact that they enabled it with a experience that was fundamentally connected to that malaise is really why they're getting the backlash. And so I think people will want to still have those sort of intentionally inefficient experiences to go through that that craft process for themselves.
You've said something interesting, which is I think AI agents work really well in technical domains where you're looking for something, you're interacting with it, you're getting specific items. In areas where you have the craft, where you have some level of artistry. And yes, posting on Blue Sky can be seen as some form of artistry if you're posting an image or if you're interacting with the platform. There is a pushback from the community in terms of what can be seen as an authentic experience. So I think finding the right use case is really the key. Because as you said, if you're doing it for code or if you're doing it for technical domains, the efficiency is amazing. And we're seeing great adoption. But in areas that touch on human experiences, you got to be careful.
I can't wait until the future where I buy, you know, like a box of software from someone and it's, you know, hand-coded by human engineers. And, you know, it's on a set of diskettes that I have to install one after the other.
Your farmer's market software that you go to buy artisanally, crafted by the people, you know, sitting software behind the table with their laptop. I want some of that.
That's right.
Bio-organic.
Yeah, bio-organic. So.
Purposely has some bugs for nostalgia.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm going to actually move us on to our final topic, just a kind of quick hit before we wrap up for the day. And it's actually on kind of a somewhat related story in some ways. Ezra Klein penned an interesting op-ed for the New York Times, basically entitled, like, What I Saw in San Francisco. And it's a kind of travel log of his recent trip in the Bay Area. I think the most interesting thing about it is he sort of describes talking to a lot of people who are both nervous about AI, but also increasingly kind of reliant on AI, right? You know, throwing all the contents of their personal journals into these systems, you know, increasingly relying on these systems for not just kind of software engineering, all the practical enterprise things we've been talking about, but sort of the personal stuff. And I think the most interesting distinction that he draws is kind of this idea between sort of cognitive offloading, which is sort of you're taking a task and you're kind of handing it off to something versus the sort of notion of cognitive surrender. Like, oh, well, now, you know, in some ways the AI is just kind of substituting for my thought. And I thought that was kind of a useful and interesting distinction, but I kind of wanted to spend a few minutes interrogating it because it sounds very good, right? We don't want the cognitive surrender. We want the cognitive offloading. But I guess the main question that I had was, you know, is that a good way of thinking about the AI applications we want or we don't want, or are things maybe a little bit more complicated than that? I'm leading a little bit there, but I am kind of interested in what you all think about that. I guess, Mia, maybe I'll throw it to you if you've got a kind of quick hit on that.
Yeah, I love it. I think I think it also originates from cognitive overload. So if you've used AI for a long time, you know that it's very easy to get caught in the trap of giving it a task, and then you give it some feedback. Maybe you start another AI agent, maybe you start another AI tool, and you realize that you're doing a lot more work, but you have to be very responsive to the AI. So that leads to cognitive overloading. You're multitasking heavily, and you're making a series of small decisions. And it's basically like working with children or teaching somebody something. It gets to a point where you have to be very careful that you answer the right questions, that you give it the right task in order to get good results. Because of that cognitive overload, it's very easy to get into cognitive surrender as well, which is, you know what, I'm just going to go through the script here and here and here and here and here for every one of those agents. So I can see how using AI is great for cognitive offloading for specific tasks, but if you try to take on too much work in parallel, it can lead to decision fatigue, which can lead to basically cognitive fatigue. So I think there are going to be more and more of these situations in the future.
I like that point about cognitive overload leading to the cognitive surrender, because I've certainly found myself doing that. The point that I was thinking when I read this was that the delta at the start of a task is whether or not you could do it on your own without the assistant there in place. And again, thinking very much from the coding domain, there are many domains of coding where I could get myself into the right headspace to go do the problem on my own, read all the code, understand every line of it, and actually solve the problem myself. But it's quicker to use an agent. So that's cognitive offloading. Whereas if I got put in front of a task of actually building a UI or a front end, good luck, right? I am not a UI person. I would be fully cognitive surrender in that space. But I think your point is an interesting subtlety to that, Mihai, is that even in domains where you can reasonably assume that you could get the job done yourself, if you reach cognitive overload, you never actually hit that point where you take ownership over the process and ownership over the cognitive value that's created when you offload it. And then you silently slip into cognitive, forgot the word. You silently slip into cognitive release. What word are we using here? Surrender, that's the word. Surrender. You silently slip into cognitive surrender as my brain shuts off. I think... The thing that I've been thinking a lot about in this domain is not necessarily it being an either or, like a pure linear trajectory of either you are owning the task or you are surrendering the task, but rather sort of a balance that you have to strike with your own workflow of where and when you choose to reclaim ownership and where and when you choose to establish trust in the process that you don't need ownership. And I'm thinking about this again. Everything I'm doing is coming from the development perspective. I think every, you know, developer has their own place where they would like to establish ownership. For me, I have always cared a great deal about Git commit hygiene. I love a beautiful Git tree. I have very strong opinions about the squash merge. Don't ask. I will talk your ear off. But the point being that for me, when code hits my Git repository is when it becomes my code, even if I didn't write it. So I have been working very carefully on a flow where I use cognitive offloading to produce a delta, but then I look at it carefully while I'm crafting my sequence of commits that say, this is what this delta actually does. And for each piece of that delta, I say, you used full AI automation, I used draft AI automation and then I edited it, or I used no AI automation. So I've started to attribute it at the commit level. And that works really well for me because that's my mental model of how code gets established is commit by commit. For others, it might be at the PR level. For others, it might be at the project level. But each individual and then probably increasingly team is going to have to establish their norms about where you reclaim that ownership from the cognitive offloading, because if you don't reclaim ownership, then you're in cognitive surrender, right? If you never reclaim the ownership, then ultimately it's not your product and you don't have the mental model to maintain it going forwards.
Sandy, do you want to do a final word on this? I'm curious about how you think and about this. And I think also just in the context of the discussion we're having earlier, it sort of feels like maybe we'll have this bell curve, right? Some people will be like, I don't want to touch this stuff ever. And some people are going to go all in. And I don't know. Curious about how you think about where this all goes.
I think I was going to say two-way relationship, but it's really a three relationship between you, your employer, and AI, right? But I literally had a conversation with my boss a few days ago. I'm working in a subject area. I'm doing a lot of competitive research and product strategy for something that I'm not an expert in, right? So leaning heavily on AI, realizing that it is so overwhelming the amount of material that I am being fed, right? And then because I'm also a type of human that works well when I'm collaborating with things, I'm always talking to it, I'm always asking questions. But that also means that I'm struggling a little bit to differentiate my own opinions from what the AI is telling me is its opinion of how things should work, right? And I can push back, but when you're not a subject expert in that area, it's hard to know what to push back on, right? So two things have kind of come out of that. One is I realized, I don't know if anyone on this podcast or in the audience has seen the show Pluribus. It's like this concept of the whole world becomes infected with a virus and we all become one.
Okay.
And I almost feel like sometimes I am Pluribus, right? Like I am infected with this virus where we are all becoming one, and my opinion is not necessarily always differentiated from what I'm being fed. And so I have to do more pushing back. But in order to have the time to do that pushing back, I have to have grace from my employer, because the expectation of the speed I should be moving because I have the help of AI is exponential compared to the speed at which I could actually move if I didn't have its help, right? So I've literally asked for, hey, I need more time to do this because I need to do less AI research. Because when I do AI research, I'm not sure we're actually answering the right questions, like Mihai said, or getting at the right problems even, right? Because I'm being told what the problem is and I'm being told what the answer is. So I think there's an aspect in there. And when you have CEOs, and I can't remember whether it was NVIDIA or Microsoft or Google or one of them that were saying that, you know, you shouldn't be using less than X amount of tokens. If you're using less than X amount of tokens, then you're not taking advantage of AI and I want to know who you are, you know? And it's like, I think that's true in a way, but it needs to be used appropriately. You use it for everything and you're going to get a bunch of Pluribus AI slop.
Well, you know what you get on MOE. It is the biggest utopian fantasies, orbital data centers, and also the biggest dystopian visions of the world. That's all the time that we have for today. Gabe, Mihai, Sandy, thanks for joining us on the show. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixer of Experts.